Hello, everyone. I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Media Network Plus. We begin today's program taking a look at a story that we have been talking about over the last 3 months and doing updates on, and that involves Tonga in the Pacific. Media freedom has come under the spotlight there ever since the Prime Minister threatened the public broadcaster over his dissatisfaction of their reporting. The government has since fired the board chair and the general manager of the Tonga Broadcasting Commission, the latter of which is now before the court. Koro Vakaute reports.
They have become an enemy of government. They claim the freedom of media should be allowed, should be the same with any other media in Tonga. But they should understand there's a basic difference between a private media and also government media. Their main role, to me, is to facilitate the work of the government.
Those were the comments that signalled a growing rift in the relationship between Mr. Pōhiwa and the Tonga Broadcasting Commission, the TBC. A consultant with the TBC says the comments and threats to allow another company to take over its services affected its news coverage. The TBC chair and general manager were also sacked. Laumanu Petelo says staff were initially intimidated.
It's to changing our stories to focus more on things that will be positive to government rather than getting stories that are balanced and unbiased. And so we felt that we were kind of changing our roles to trying to fit in to what the Prime Minister and government wanted.
However, Ms. Petelo says she feels with court proceedings and media coverage of the affair, things are starting to improve. The Acting General Manager, Mele Kamoto, says uncertainty remains.
Oh, I'm sort of, if I can say, unbalanced myself, because you don't really know what's the future of TBC. And what would that be the effect, especially on us management staff?
New chair Ahungalo Fusimalohi says it's his job to clean up the TBC's act in terms of revenue and infrastructure, but also in terms of news coverage.
There can be no political interference, which is guaranteed under our constitution, and the government is wary of that. But to say, label us an enemy, they're actually referring to some news pieces that they believe is not correct, and I have to look into it.
Mr. Fusimalohi says he's reviewing the TBC from top to bottom. Meanwhile, prominent publisher Kalafi Moala says the saga has impacted the whole media landscape.
You've got media that have kind of moved back to a position where their criticism of government or government policy is kind of being softened up. And then you have media that have crossed the line and gone over and become a government puppet. There's been a culture of fear in media. And it's not a fear of just media freedom. It's a fear that if government doesn't support them, they're going to go down financially. Government is still the biggest advertiser in the country.
However, chair of the Tonga Media Council, Pese Funua, says while he doesn't condone the Prime Minister's actions, he says life goes on for other media. Mr. Funua says there's always been a split of pro- and anti-government media outlets in Tonga.
It's almost like a party politics. Party's paper, they support this and they support that. But they still have a benefit in a way, that's how I look at it. And I mean, it's up for you what you want to read, but you have all different views. So if you look at it squarely, you can have a good coverage of what's happening.
Mr. Funua also says nowhere has news coverage like Nukualofa, where he says there are five newspapers to cater for a population of about 40,000. But a political researcher believes the media saturation may be problematic.
You see certain media outlets siding with this government, and the previous governments had a whole lot of different allies in the media. And so we lose the integrity of information. So no wonder the electorate, the community is in tatters and confused.
Akalisi Pōhiwa has indicated he believes the TBC feud is over. However, former general manager Nanase Fifita is currently before the courts seeking reinstatement. This is Koro Vakaute.
In the wake of the terrorist attacks in London, Manchester, and now Melbourne's shooting and siege, social media and online messaging sites are being called on to do more to crack down on online extremism. Australia's Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has joined a number of online leaders that have accused Facebook and Twitter of shrinking off their responsibility. But whose responsibility is it really to monitor and stem communications that relates to violence and terrorist activity? Fran Kelly speaks next to Nigel Fair, director of the Centre of Internet Safety at the University of Canberra.
Yeah, I really don't know how many actual people are engaged in it, but a lot of people are. And When you look at the amount of time that we spend in online environments ourselves socially, you know, really it's just another public place and we should spend our time lawfully and responsibly and ethically. But of course, like every other public place, there's people out there trying to groom others. And in this case, often for illicit purposes being terrorism.
So when Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, came out and accused the internet companies of providing safe spaces for these people, Malcolm Turnbull followed up. He agreed. He said Prime Minister Theresa May put a finger on a very important point. There is too much tolerance of extremist material on social media, and that requires cooperation from the big social media platforms, in particular Facebook and Twitter. He said authorities also should be given access to private communications, such as encrypted messages. So is the Prime Minister right? Do the big media platforms like Facebook and Twitter, do they need to do more to clamp down on extremist thought on their platforms?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting set of questions. So yes, they should do a lot more. Yeah, they profiteer handsomely out of you and I and all the listeners out there being online all day, every day. Yeah, very heavily targeted ads. They know what we do. They geolocate us. They do everything like that. And they could really step up to the plate and curate their sites. As I said, a public place a whole lot better.
Mm. Well, they say they are. I mean, Facebook and Twitter both say they work aggressively to remove terrorist content from their platform. And the director of policy at Facebook, Simon Milner, said the company does not allow terrorists to establish groups on its platform or share extremist material.
Well, of course, you know, terrorists, like a lot of criminals, are quite rational and smart people in a lot of respects. And they're just not going to put up a Facebook page saying, you know, welcome to terrorist A organisation. They're going to do it a lot more subtly. They're going to slowly seep their message out there. They're going to look for sympathetic people. They're going to try and raise funds. They're going to do a whole lot of other, just very slowly chipping away at people and get them ingrained into their way of thinking. Of course, when we look at the other side of the coin, if we know where they are online, and of course, We know that they're not going to set up their terrorist activities by using, you know, open source communications, but they're going to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc., to do their other just normal social media things like we do, like taking a photo of what we had for dinner and telling all our friends. So while we've got them there, we can sort of track them around a fair bit. And remembering we've got some great metadata laws that allow enforcement agencies to sort of see who these people are and what they're doing and find a greater picture about who they are, their associates, and the sorts of things they're doing. So we kind of don't want to shut them out completely, but the sites need to do a whole lot more. And sure, they talk the talk, but I'm not seeing them walk the walk yet.
So just to be clear then, Nigel, a little more on this, what exactly would you have the sites do? Because as you say, the intelligence agencies want to be able to follow these people's daily exchanges to see who's talking to who and to try and sort of read between the lines on things if it comes to that. What would you have Facebook and Twitter, for instance, do in particular?
Well, I think we need law enforcement agencies embedded with them. You know, call it even physically embedded with them, but at least strongly virtually. And going back to my analogy of the internet and social media being a public place, as we spend more time online, law enforcement agencies should also be spending more time online, and not just in doing an investigative procedures, but also in crime prevention and outreach and education and all those other things to try and get to some of these people before they get groomed by, the ISIS and other, you know, type organisations. There's a lot that can be done from the whole law enforcement practice.
Okay, but that's from the law enforcement end. Again, specifically, what would you have Facebook and Twitter do that they are not doing now that you can see anyway? Because they are saying they're doing plenty.
Sure. They are doing some work. They just need to put a whole lot more resources into it. And again, they know what we do because they target us with advertising. And you know, the sceptic in me looks at things like the Facebook I'm All Right button that came out after the London bombings. And, you know, really that just drives more traffic to their site, which drives more advertising to their site, which is a win for them and their share price.
So they're getting a benefit, in your sense, by this this community spirit. But
absolutely.
Is there one act you would have them do to change, who they target or how quickly they move things down or blocking things?
Well, it's going to come down to two things. It's going to be image recognition. It's going to be text recognition. and then it's putting the intelligent smarts around what it all means, and then putting that picture together. And it's putting the picture together, which is probably the key to both of those, and then going to law enforcement and saying, we're seeing these trends from these users, and they will put their own assessment around that and sort of say, yes, we think that's appropriate. No, we don't think it is. And I think it also comes down to what our social norms are in real life and transposing those to online, because we sort of don't have any much definitions of what should be blocked and what shouldn't be blocked.
And that's another question which I'll come to in a moment. But you're right, they've got big dough and big data. They should be able to do a fair bit by now. It's 22 past eight. Nigel Fair is the director of the Centre for Internet Safety at the University of Canberra. This other element of our Prime Minister's comments yesterday, when Malcolm Turnbull said authorities should be given access to private communications such as encrypted messages. Are encrypted messaging services and apps, which are quite common now, an app like WhatsApp or Viber, are they actually more crucial or critical here than the open social media sites like Facebook? And should these encrypted messaging services be monitored or shut down altogether, or should authorities be given greater access to them? Is that possible?
Well the last point is a critical one. And, of course, our Prime Minister is well known on the record for saying that he uses WhatsApp and amongst his cabinet colleagues all use it. So I think we've got to wind the clock back to the Arab Spring of, some 4, maybe 5 years ago. And these apps were lauded then as being great for democracy. They were great for dissidents to get their message out of various Middle Eastern locations. And everyone was saying it's great. Now it's turned around the other way, and everyone's going, well, now we're seeing criminals and terrorists use it. So all of a sudden, it's not so great. And I think we've just got to be wary of, again, with our definition of, what's good for one lot of people may not be good for another. But the reality is, technically, these platforms, their value proposition is no one can eavesdrop. And once we start talking about backdoors into these products, we also start going to, well, who should have access to that backdoor? And when should it be? And so when we look at the WannaCry attacks that happened about 2 weeks ago now, that you had a vulnerability in a Microsoft product, which the US government was using. It got released unauthorized, and then all of a sudden a bunch of criminals used it and took down the National Health Service and a whole bunch of other places. We start getting into that realm of discussion. What if we just have it and only the US are allowed to have it? And then what if it gets leaked? And then should it be the broader Five Eyes communities? And then who else should have it? And then we start thinking of, what agency should be allowed to have it, under what type of warrant? It's a bit of a slippery slope, which I don't agree with. And there's other investigative methods out there which law enforcement needs to use and definitely are using.
Nigel, thank you very much for joining us.
Frank Kelly speaking to Nigel Fair, and I'm sure that's a story that we'll be covering more of in the future. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file. The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Staying on the subject of the internet that we were talking about a moment ago, what are some of the more interesting ways in which websites are designing their sites or story pages for news consumption? From a black, stripped, to an almost text-only style, to designs that take the web beyond simply being a magazine layout and just putting it online and actually becoming more vibrant. Well, what's been happening, actually a lot has been happening, if you just take a look at, say, the new and upcoming websites and websites designed, as you're probably aware, we are changing the PCJ site. We're still working on it right now, but it is coming very soon. We've just been quite busy with a few other things. Next, Richard Ady speaks to Justin Sinclair. He's the user experience designer at Radio Multiplatform of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
That's actually two interesting kind of things going on at the same time. So one is to say that, you know, people are using these kind of tools like, you know, Instapaper or something like Flipboard or what have you, to essentially kind of strip out, you know, all the kind of extraneous information from an article. They're saying, look, I'm glad that you've got 17 ads on your desktop website and that you've got 24 different kind of calls to action telling me, hey, how about this over here? How about that over here? That's great, but I actually, you know, can't read that way. And so they're actually saying, you know, give that content to me in a way that kind of strips all that stuff out. And that's kind of suitable both on, you know, like for mobile or also on a desktop. And there's another kind of thing saying, you know, look, as a reader, I want a really, you know, evocative kind of rich experience, which sort of gives me more than the text. And that's about saying that, look, there are a bunch of people kind of publishing much more sort of magazine style kind of layouts that, you know, are rich with imagery, you know, animation, movement, as well as the text, to kind of, you know, I suppose, be evocative and give you that sort of experience, which is more than just the words.
That's going to lend itself to different things. And actually, the way you have talked about this, there's what you might call art-directed content, and there's, I suppose, novel presentation. Let's talk about the art-directed content. You've already touched upon it. You've got a few examples from the, I suppose, the lightest approach to the heaviest. Mm-hmm. So this one is from a website called The Morning News with the slightly unpromising title of 99 Bottles of Pee on the Wall. What are they doing here?
Apart from having a really evocative title, that I think which is great. Morning News is a dedicated kind of online publication, and what they do is A, have, you know, incredibly nice sort of type and design, but B, they're doing custom illustration for a lot of their articles, and they're sort of laying them out, you know, really beautifully with kind of nice big pull quotes and, you know, arrayed through the article.
It's like a magazine with not too much illustration, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you've largely got like a single kind of nicely set out sea of type, but they're sort of just bringing it to life with little kind of touches here and there.
All right. Well, in the next example, it's a completely different approach. This is something from Boing Boing, which is a very well-known, long-established and very influential blog. This particular story, it's about getting on with things, More Rock it's called, and it uses those sort of stylized images that we first saw in gaming technology emerging in the 80s.
Yeah, it's a really beautifully done piece. And yeah, they've got this sort of, you know, great 8-bit Nintendo,
yes,
you know, Sega Master System aesthetic. And doing these you know, lovely kind of custom illustrations, you know, sitting on, you know, nice kind of charcoal background, breaking up what is a pretty fun sort of, you know, call to action, I suppose.
And it beautifully illustrates what they're talking about, which is, yeah, it's the difference between saying something and seeing something or doing something.
That's right. And it's a really powerful connection of that imagery to the text.
All right. Well, let's go to the heaviest example of all. This is from ESPN, the sport broadcaster, and they have a very good website. The story is The Long, Strange Trip of Doc Ellis. This is a pitcher who, in 1970, the story goes, it's quite mythologized, this, he was high, he was having an acid trip, and he had to go out and pitch. Didn't think he'd be playing, had to go out and pitch, and pitched what the Americans call a no-hitter. No one was able to hit him that day.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. If nothing else, you know, you should just go and read this story, because it's a really fun kind of read.
And it's amazing how it's been done. It's not just the story. So there's pictures of him, and as you scroll down, the text moves, but the picture doesn't, until all of a sudden it does, and we get a close-up, and we get a key part of the story highlighted, and then we go down further, and we get a ticket stub from the day, almost. That's what it looks like to me. And it's just a very, very rich visual environment.
Yeah, some of the other pieces we've been looking at today are drawing a lot from, you know, what we might call kind of magazine layout and sort of editorial print design. And this sort of definitely has that aspect, but it takes it further.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're seeing is kind of, you know, inspired by things like, you know, pan and zoom in a movie or movement in games. And so what you have is, you know, different kinds of elements are scrolling and panning at different times. It's very rich, it's very visual, it connects amazingly well with the story, but it's the most experimental of,
yes,
of these. Because like some of these kind of techniques, you know, do, I suppose, risk, you know, being zhuzhi, you know, look at me, rather than being about sort of going, well, this is an article and the kind of key thing is the text in it.
That's a nicer word. I would have said risk being wanky. Zhuzhi sounds better. Let's talk very briefly about novel presentation. So not the art direction as much. We know from the Global Mail, which I still think is good, that horizontal scrolling doesn't work. They eventually abandoned it. Nobody really liked it. There are other things too. ITV in the UK are doing this thing, their own sort of scrolling approach. What are they trying here, actually?
Well, this is about sort of saying, you know, what is the form of a news site? And so we're kind of used to, you know, news sites like, you know, Sydney Morning Herald or The Age or New York Times being, you know, sort of an array of different stories with kind of like small excerpts. And then, you know, you kind of, you know, from this sea of stories, you're supposed to pick something out, click and kind of go and get the detailed version of that. And ITV News have sort of turned that on its head.
It's a vertical thing, isn't it? It's, you kind of go up and down, and you can always go back up to the top by clicking on an arrow.
Yeah, so they're doing a thing which says that, you know, news is a stream of content, and it happens, you know, in a time order, and that time order is important. And so it's kind of supporting that, okay, what's just happened? And they're actually doing a little bit more than that, because they're pulling out, they go, well, okay, not only is it just a stream of all the stuff that's happening, but they go, look, for today, and maybe even for this week, there's maybe, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 different things, and we'll pull that out. And we'll kind of give you direct navigation to, you know, what we think are the most important things. So unlike a traditional newspaper where you might have, say, your politics section, you might have an environment section, you might have a lifestyle section, they're saying that, look, you know, the important story for right now is that the Church of England is, you know, refusing women bishops.
Okay.
And giving you that as a kind of a key pull-out.
It's almost the opposite, the next example, isn't it? This is Evening Edition, which is once a day just putting together what they think is the most important stuff.
Yeah, that's right. So it is actually almost the complete antithesis of ITV News. ITV News sort of supports that. I'm going to keep on going back. I'm going to keep on checking in. What's latest? What's now? Whereas Evening Edition says, look, you know, you've probably got too much of that in your life.
Yes.
You know, you've got like so many things you need to be on top of, so many people you need to kind of keep track of. And it is drawing on that sort of old kind of print tradition of there being like a morning edition of a paper and an evening edition of the paper. And the evening edition of the paper would sort of say, you know, this is all the important things that you needed to know that happened today.
I want to talk about one more example, and this is it's somebody who's taken what The Guardian is doing, so a very well-known paper, a very well-resourced website, and actually giving it even more of a tweak. This is guardian.gifford.com, and what we're getting is one story at a time.
Yeah, so Phil, he's a great designer from the UK, by the way, had this idea that when you read a paper, there's a sense of completeness. That you can go from the start of the paper to the end of the paper and go, I have consumed all the news that's fit for today. And what he was seeing is that on, you know, news sites, there is no sense of completeness. Like there's like this endless sea of content.
Yes.
Kind of going, you know, forwards and backwards. And it's like,
ITV, you've got the endless river of content that keeps flowing. We've just talked about.
That's right. And so his thing was like, it's actually very satisfying to kind of think, well, I've read all the news that's fit for today. I can rest easy. And also he's kind of like, a traditional newspaper site like NY Times, you know, you've got like, I think on the homepage they have close to 100 different items that kind of counted one day, which is nuts. Don't do that.
No.
And they're asking you to make a lot of choices. And he's saying, let's strip out choice because choice, you know, is kind of a stressful sort of thing to impose on people. And we're actually quite good at kind of going in linear fashion. So he's saying, look, you know, you can look at one article at a time and you can quickly decide whether you care about it or not. And you can flick to the next. And so you can use your kind of, you know, arrow keys to kind of just go, yes, I care, yes, don't care, yes, care. Oh, that's an interesting one. Let's stop. And let's pause at that. And that kind of maps to the way that people read a newspaper. In the fact that you can flick open a page, you can quickly scan that page, see if you care about it or not, and move to the next.
All right, it's now time to turn our attention to propagation, what's been happening, and what we can expect over the next 7 days. Here's our king of propagation. I'm going to call him now the king of propagation, Glenn Hauser.
Keith, Space Weather Services Australia makes a global HF propagation forecast of normal through June 10th at all latitude bands. Space Weather South Africa through June 10th sees magnetic conditions quiet, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. China's Space Environment Prediction Center foresees solar flux no higher than 75 through July 4th, planetary A index peaking at 16 on June 13th, and 15 on June 16th. Per Met Office UK through June 11th, solar activity expected to remain low or very low, with a continued chance of common class flare activity. Geomagnetic activity mainly quiet, with a slight chance of unsettled intervals. F.K. Janda in Prague says the geomagnetic field will be quiet on June 9th, 20th, 21st, 27th, 28th. Quiet to active on June 10th, 12th, 13th, 23rd, and 25th. Active to disturbed on June 11th, 15th, 16th, 24th. Quiet to unsettled June 14th, 18th, 22nd, 26th. And mostly quiet on June 17th and 19th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field expected to be mostly quiet with unsettled to active levels June 14th to 19th. And G1 minor geomagnetic storm levels likely on June 16th, with ANK indices peaking at 25 and 5. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2 through June 13th, and again from the 20th. Solar flux 78, except for a spike to 80 on June 12th, and June 27th onwards. William Hepburn's VHF, UHF maps show extreme tropospheric ducting increasing off west coast of Mexico from June 9th to 13th. As always, off the west coast of Africa around Cabo Verde all week. Off the coast of Angola, June 9th to 13th. Across the central Mediterranean, June 10th to 12th. And western Mediterranean, June 10th and 11th. All around the Arabian Peninsula, as far as India, all week. Between South Korea and China, June 11th. And in North America, look for FM sporadic EDX through the rest of June.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Once again, if you want to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Until next time, so long and take care.